Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
And it's Free for All Friday here on the Council of Trent podcast. Hope you're having a happy Valentine's Day to all of you out there. And I always appreciate the love that you send to the podcast, especially the support at TrentOrenPodcast.com, which makes the podcast possible and gets you access to bonus content, sneak previews, the ability to submit questions to me to air on our open mailbag segments, and a little thank you video from me that you can share with your friends and loved ones. All that and more at TrentOrenPodcast.com for as little as $5 a month. You can get access to all that and make this possible. Oh, and you also get now the, I'm doing the rebuttal series on YouTube, and you can access that. It's on YouTube, but you can get an audio version to listen to in your free time if you're a subscriber at TrentHornPodcast.com. Do go and check that out. Today's episode, I want to talk about when life imitates art. We talk about art imitating life, but sometimes life can imitate art itself, that art can change the world around us and make it different, or there can be spooky coincidences between pieces of art, film, literature, television, and the world. That is what I want to talk to you all about today. In fact, the playwright, the poet Oscar Wilde once said, "Life imitates art far more than art imitates life." And George Bernard Shaw once said, "I have noticed that when a certain type of feature appears in painting and is admired as beautiful, it presently becomes common in nature, so that the Beatrices and Francescas and the picture galleries of one generation come to life as the parlor maids and waitresses of the next." So the first bit of life imitating art that I want to talk to you about is definitely one where the art shaped the world. And I was mentioning this because I was talking to my wife a few nights ago about movies and movie names. And I said that the movie Splash, starring Tom Hanks, this is back in like 1985, it's where he meets a mermaid played by, I think it's Daryl Hannah. And, you know, it's kind of a romantic comedy, a real fish out of water story. They met as kids, and he like jumped off a boat and she like saved his life. But then he's pulled back on the boat and he's always wondering if that was real. And she ends up really saving his life later when he almost drowns, and she comes on land to meet him and she's in love with him. And she tries to learn what it's like to be human. I think the deal with her was, it's not Little Mermaid stuff. It's like when she gets on land, she grows legs. But if she's splashed with water, she turns back into a mermaid. And so she's trying to figure out what life is like on land. And she ends up going to like a department store and watches a bunch of TV shows. And she's able to learn English that way. And so they're walking down. So previously she couldn't speak and they couldn't communicate. And then she learned English by watching TV. And they're walking down Madison Avenue. I think this is in New York. And then, you know, they have a conversation. He says, "Well, what do I call you? What's your name?"
What are English names?
Well, there's millions of them, I guess. Jennifer, Joni, Hillary. But careful, hey, those are hot. See, names. Linda, Kim, where are we? Madison. Elizabeth.
Madison.
Samantha.
Madison, I like Madison.
Well, Madison's not a name. Well, all right. Okay, fine. Madison it is. Good thing we weren't at 149th Street.
And so actually, according to this article at Yahoo Entertainment, how a splash joke led to the Madison baby name boom. So it actually wasn't a name unless you were like a U.S. president or a city in Wisconsin. But according to Joel Ryan, author of Puffy, Xena, Quentin, Uma, and 10,000 Other Names for Your New Millennium Baby, Madison was nowhere on the radar as a girl name until 1985, a year after the release of Splash. So there definitely seems to be a connection there, especially since there's no other major female Madison, either real or fictional, who is out there as a role model. So Ryan will tell you about the power of pop culture has over baby naming conventions. Look no further than the uptick in girls named Isabella because of people who love Twilight, or boys named, this can't be real, boys named Espen because of the popularity of the cable network ESPN. Really? I don't believe in that. If you know somebody named Espen, not Aspen, like the Colorado city, ESPEN, Espen, please leave a comment at TrentHornPodcast.com if they were named after ESPN. Actually, there is a woman, you can look this up on Wikipedia. Her name is Marijuana Pepsi. Her mom named her Marijuana Pepsi, And then she actually went and got her PhD in unusual names in the African-American community. So now she's Dr. Pepsi. So, you know, there's a Dr. Pepsi out there. Her name is Marijuana Pepsi. So I sort of understand countries that have rules that say you have to pick from a list of names for people. I'm not a fan of government infiltration in your life, and I probably wouldn't approve of such a list in our own country. But I can get how sometimes, you know, if you're going to name your kid, don't pick a name that you think is, oh, this is so fun or sweet, or oh, I really enjoy this. A person's name is important for them to be integrated into society. And if you give them a really strange or bizarre name, you're creating a lot more obstacles. So it's just something to keep in mind. You may have justifying reasons for a name that's not common. That's fine. But try to keep one thing in consideration when you're naming your child, how the name will affect them as they get older. So, and I know a lot of Madisons, of course, but all of them, I think all of the Madisons I know are younger than I am, because I was born in 1985. I don't know any Madisons, women at least, who are older than I am, because the name wasn't popular before I was born. So that's one example of life imitating art. There's a few others on here that are, they're more like kind of spooky coincidences we'll go through. This is from the BBC. Was H.G. Wells the first person to think of the atom bomb? So H.G. Wells first imagined a uranium-based hand grenade that would continue to explode indefinitely in his 1914 novel, The World Set Free. He even thought it would be dropped from planes. What he couldn't predict was how a strange conjunction of his friends and acquaintances, notably Winston Churchill, who read all of Wells' novels, and the physicist Leo Szilard, would turn the idea from fantasy to reality. And so later on in the 20th century, scientists discovered quantum physics and the atomic world and how to split the atom, create fission and fission reactions. And Churchill grasped the danger of technology running ahead of human maturity. In a 1924 article, he wrote, Shall We All Commit Suicide? He said, might a bomb no bigger than an orange be found to possess a secret power to destroy a whole block of buildings? Nay, to concentrate the force of 1,000 tons of cordite and blast a township at a stroke. And actually, the core of an, it's not as big as an orange. A nuclear bomb is even the smallest one's the size of a suitcase. But the core of a nuclear bomb might be about the size of an orange. And it has explosive charges around it to set it off. And actually, it says later in the article that Wells called it, let's see here, Szilard called it atomic energy, but it was Wells, I think, who actually called it an atomic bomb. And so that's where it was predicted decades before it was before the first nuclear device was exploded in New Mexico. It was called Trinity. And so there's a great documentary you can catch on Amazon, Trinity. I think it's called Trinity and Beyond, but it shows all the nuclear test explosions and talks about the development. I will put this out there. Don't quote, I think it's true. I think it's like 50% true. I remember reading once that when it came to the development of the nuclear bomb, there was like a small chance it was believed that the bomb would not stop exploding. But they figured, well, we should probably go through with this anyways. We need this to end the war. So, I mean, it's what we've come up with is it's frightening. You think of Robert Oppenheimer, who quoted the Bhagavad Gita about the Manhattan Project and about the atomic bomb, quoting this epic Hindu poem, you know, saying, I am death, destroyer of worlds, when he described the bomb. Another one that goes into nuclear incidents that come to strange things of life imitating art is the China Syndrome and Three Mile Island. So the China Syndrome was a film that came out in 1979. And it's about a nuclear power plant that experiences a meltdown. And so what happens is they're not able to read the fuel gauges correctly, and there's not enough coolant. And China Syndrome, the word China Syndrome refers to the idea of the nuclear material melting down, becoming this super hot, not magma, kind of like magma, like this super hot material that can melt through concrete and through the earth and go all the way through the earth to China, even though it couldn't really do that. Even if something could melt its way through the earth, gravity would keep it at the center of the earth, but nothing could ever melt down and get that far based on the laws of physics as we have them. So this is one of the scenes in China Syndrome where everything starts to go awry.
Everybody relax.
Got high water in the core and I'm gonna dump it.
Wherever it's coming from, we gotta get rid of it. Look at this, Ted.
Uh-oh.
Hey, Barney.
Yo.
Open 14 and 15.
You can't do that, Jack.
Open them, Barney.
Jack, you can't do it. The book says you can't
do
it.
We're almost up to the steam lines.
Hey, Jack.
What?
Look at this water level indicator. Water level's low.
This says it's high.
Water, Barney, give me some water!
So he taps the indicator and realizes that it's wrong, and it's giving him the wrong indicator on the coolant in the reactor tank. The coolant keeps the uranium rods from overheating and creating an uncontrollable fission reaction, which is what happened at Chernobyl, for example, at the nuclear power plant in Chernobyl, which you can see on the HBO miniseries Chernobyl. This happened 12 days before the Three Mile Island accident that took place in Londonderry Township in Pennsylvania, March 28, 1979. What happened here, that accident, it was a partial meltdown. What happened was the accident began with failures in the non-nuclear secondary system. It was followed by a stuck open pilot-operated relief valve in the primary system, which allowed large amounts of nuclear reactor coolant to escape. The mechanical failures were compounded by the initial failure of plant operators to recognize the situation as a loss of coolant accident due to, wait for this, whether it was human factors, human-computer interaction, and design oversights related to ambiguous control room indicators in the power plant's user interface. So this movie, so China Syndrome, comes out 12 days before the Three Mile Island accident, and the cause of the accident is like almost the same in each film. In fact, they pulled China Syndrome from movie theaters at the time because they didn't want to make it seem like they were capitalizing on the accident to sell movie tickets, even though the movie had come out before the accident ever happened. So Life Imitating Art, China Syndrome, and the Three Mile Island accident in Pennsylvania in 1979. Our next one is a series of movie predictions in the film Americathon. So Americathon is kind of this dystopian film, another 1979 film, and it makes predictions about the future, specifically the year 1998. And it's kind of a dystopian film. It's got some funny people in it. It's got John Ritter, Fred Willard. It's also got appearances by Jay Leno and the singer Meatloaf. And it's about predicting what life is like in 1998, and there's economic collapse, we're out of oil. Now, that part it got wrong, but it actually made other predictions that were not far off, including like insane reality television show programming. So there's a scene in here where there's like a show about a guy going into a boxing match, beating up his own mother. And it's Jay Leno who's doing it, so I'll play that clip for you here.
The fight has been brewing for over 30 years, and Adele has vowed to prove to her son, like she's told him a million times before, your mother is always right, and what a right she has. On the other hand, Larry never writes, so she's really steamed.
Mr. Referee, is this any way for a boy to tie his gloves?
Shut up, Ma!
No way to talk to your mother, little poopy butt.
I told you not to call me that.
Poopy butt, poopy butt, poopy butt.
I'm gonna kill you, Ma!
And then they get into the ring and he starts boxing his mother. Roger Ebert gave the film like half a star. It's a terrible film. It's not very good. But it does make some interesting predictions. This is 1979, and it predicted by the year 1998 that China would embrace capitalism and become a superpower. But back in 1979, China was still reeling from economic malaise. That was a far-out conclusion. It predicted the collapse of the Soviet Union. Nike would become a big multinational company. The dollar would be devalued, and we'd be in debt to foreign lenders. It also predicted, though closer, that a governor of California would become president in the film, and that happened a year later with Ronald Reagan. So Americathon makes a lot of, it was another case of life imitating art there, whether it was conscious or unconscious, noted or unnoted, you be the judge. Here's another one. We'll add one more creepy one before we get to a lighthearted one here. This is about Edgar Allan Poe. And so Edgar Allan Poe, in 1838, he wrote a novel. Well, let me start with the real story, okay? So this is 1884. Real happened. 1884, a yacht named the Mignonette left England, headed for Sydney, Australia. And the yacht wasn't made for these trips, so it ended up sinking in a storm, and four men got into a lifeboat, but they didn't have enough provisions. And so they ended up drawing straws, and they had to... they killed one of the men and they ate him. And he was a cabin boy named Richard Parker. And so they committed cannibalism, but then they were rescued, actually. And they were put on trial. And this is the first time someone was found guilty of murder while being marooned, because for a long time, actually, I saw this is a museum exhibit at the Museum of Man in San Diego. There were a lot of cases where people would be marooned at sea in lifeboats and they would resort to cannibalism. And when they were rescued, they weren't charged with murder. It was just considered a custom of the sea that people were allowed to resort to. The crew of the Mignonette were the first people in 1884 to be charged with murder because they went and they killed the cabin boy Richard Parker in order to save themselves. That was 1884. Now, in 1838... Edgar Allan Poe published a novel, The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket. And partway through the book, there's a crew, this is from mentalfloss.com, the crew of a ship called the Grampus have a, they are marooned, they're on a lifeboat with no food or water. They catch a tortoise and strip its shell, but in order to survive, the crew draws straws to figure out which of them will be sacrificed to provide meat for everybody else. So once, like the Mignonette, there's four guys who are marooned on a lifeboat, and they have to resort to cannibalism to survive. You might think, well, that's not that much of a coincidence. That happened a lot in the 19th century. But in Edgar Allan Poe's tale, what was the name of the cabin boy who was killed? That's right. His name was Richard Parker. Can you imagine that? 1838, Poe writes this novel about cannibalism of survivors on the high seas, and they eat the cabin boy, Richard Parker. And then 1884, nearly 50 years later, the crew of the Mignonette suffer the same fate, and they cannibalize their own Richard Parker. And of course, who's the one person who would write a story with this kind of predictive power? Edgar Allan Poe, quoth the raven, nevermore. Now let's move on to something more lighthearted. You remember the film Office Space? So Office Space is a true 90s film. Came out in 1999. About a bunch of guys who are, and it's such a 90s film, it's about a bunch of guys who are upset about their relatively well-paying benefited jobs working at an insurance company, or they're working at a company. They have typical white-collar jobs. And actually, what's funny in the 1990s, it's funny when you watch films based on the decade, you see what people's fears and concerns are. So you see, you know, in the 60s and 70s, science fiction, nuclear accident films, people are worried about the growth of technology, war, destabilization. When you go to the 90s films like American Beauty or Office Space, the conflict in a lot of these films is just the malaise of life. Like, things are going slow. You got the dot-com bubble, economy is booming, things seem to be going well. People are like, well, I'm bored with life, or I feel like I'm not getting enough out of life as I want. And that was, you know, a theme in American Beauty. Office Space, they're not happy enough with their jobs that are menial and dull rather than like dangerous or anything like that. In fact, they crave some kind of danger or excitement. So these guys at this, pretty sure it's an insurance company, they hatch a plan, or a brokerage firm, whatever it is. They hatch a plan to steal money from transactions that occur, these microtransactions. So here's the main character, Peter, explaining to his girlfriend, a waitress that he goes and asks out, played by Jennifer Aniston. And he explains their scheme to kind of make a ton of money off of these transactions that occur every day at the company.
All right, so when the subroutine compounds the interest, right, it uses all these extra decimal places that just get rounded off. So we simplified the whole thing, and we round them all down and just drop the remainder into an account that we opened.
So you're stealing?
No, you don't understand. It's very complicated. It's aggregate, so I'm talking about fractions of a penny here. And over time, they add up to a lot.
Oh, okay. So you're gonna make a lot of money, right?
Yeah.
Right? That's not yours?
Well, it becomes ours.
How is that not stealing?
I don't think that I'm explaining this very well.
Okay.
The 7-Eleven, right?
Mm-hmm.
You'd take a penny from the tray.
From the crippled children?
No, that's the jar. I'm talking about the tray. The pennies for everybody.
Oh, for everybody, okay.
Yeah, well, those are whole pennies.
Right.
All right? I'm just talking about fractions of a penny here, okay? But we do it from a much bigger tray, and we do it a couple of million times. So what's wrong with that?
So, what's wrong with that, right? Let's fast forward from 1999 to... Maybe he got the idea from the film. I'm not sure. I'm trying to read the date on here. It's from Wired Magazine. I think it's May. Oh, it's 2008. Come on, Wired. Don't put a dash through your zero. It looks just like an eight. I can't tell what's going on. This is May 2008. Man allegedly bilks E-Trade Schwab of $50,000 by collecting lots of free micro deposits. This is in 2008, so in about 9 years after Office Space came out. A California man has been indicted for an inventive scheme that allegedly siphoned $50,000 from online brokerage houses E-Trade and Schwab.com in 6 months, a few pennies at a time. Michael Largent, 22, of Plumas Lake, California, allegedly exploited a loophole in a common procedure both companies follow when a customer links his brokerage account to a bank account for the first time. To verify that the account number and routing information is correct, the brokerages automatically send small micro deposits of between 2 cents to $1 to the account and ask the customer to verify that they've received it. Michael Largent allegedly used a script to open 58,000 online brokerage accounts in the name of cartoon characters and other aliases. Hank Hill, courtesy Fox Broadcasting, is one example. Largent allegedly used an automated script. Like Hank Hill from King of the Hill or Mickey Mouse or things like that. It says he allegedly used an automated script to open these accounts, accumulated thousands of dollars in micro deposits. So it says here he used different fake names that eventually the fake names gave him away. Johnny Blaze, Hank Hill, Rusty Shackelford, Dale Gribble from, I guess this guy really liked King of the Hill. The banks involved included Capital One, Metabank, Green Dot, and Skylight. May 7 Secret Service search warrant affidavit says Largent tried the same thing with Google's checkout service, accumulating over $8,000 in 8 different bank accounts at Bancor Bank. That was back in 2008. I don't know if how he was charged. This article was written when he was out on bail, but there's an example. Someone watched off. Who knows? Maybe he watched Office Space and was like, I wonder if this could work in real life. And of course, in Office Space, people get away with it, and nobody's the wiser because no one checks backup records for anything like that. Well, the company burnt down, Trent. That's why they got away with it. You know, can you please have my stapler? If you don't know these references, you can watch Office Space. Fair warning. If you had to rate it based on the USCCB guidelines, I would call it morally offensive. But otherwise, let's continue on there. The last one, our last spooky one, Wreck of the Titan. Wreck of the Titan. You all know about how the Titanic sank in 1912. Well, in 1898, Morgan Robertson wrote a novella about a ocean liner, the Titan, being struck by an iceberg. It says, although the novel was written before the RMS Titanic was even conceptualized, there are some uncanny similarities between both the fictional, which is the book was called The Wreck of the Titan or Futility, and the Titanic. Like the Titanic, the fictional ship sank in April in the North Atlantic, and there were not enough lifeboats for all the passengers. There are also similarities between the size of the ship. The Titan is 800 feet. The Titanic was 882 feet. Speed and life-saving equipment. After the Titanic sinking, some people credited Robertson with precognition and clairvoyance. Robertson denied this, and subsequent scholars attribute the similarities were a result of his extensive knowledge of shipbuilding and maritime trends. So amazing it's true, beyond fact or fiction, ladies and gentlemen. Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you have another great example of when life imitated art in an uncanny way, I would enjoy hearing about that. If you're a patron at trenthornpodcast.com, leave a comment there. Consider subscribing, or at the very least, consider leaving a review for us at iTunes or Google Play. It really helps us out here. Hope you enjoy the rest of your Valentine's Day. Take it easy, guys. Remember, the most important love in the world, it's God. God loves us. God loves you. Love him. Then love yourself. And then love others. I think it was JOY is the acronym. Jesus, others, you gives us the best and most amount of joy. Love Jesus. Well, oh goodness. Now I'm not necessarily, what is the order I'm looking for here? Jesus, others, you. But we love God and we should love ourselves. That way we have love to be able to give to other people and lead them closer to God. So JOY, J-Y-O, however you want to put the acronym, something to keep in mind today on Valentine's Day here on the Council of Trent podcast. Hope you all enjoyed time with me, and I hope you have a very blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.